Photography Podcast. It's show 22. It's the 4th of June. Good grief. Halfway through the year and nearly at the longest day. And the theme for today's show is long exposure photography, as suggested by Chris Clayton, who joins me today along with Joe Hickey and Charlie Winston. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello. All together now. Hello, hello. We'll try and sound cheerful. PhonesShowChat.uk is our website, believe it or not. I know there's a link there somewhere. Two S's in the middle. And if you get lost, you can find it all at the PodHub UK website or at tedsalmon.com, where you can get all the links to everything from as well. And don't forget that we've got our PSC Photography Shared Album in Google Photos, where all the stuff we're going to talk about today on the show will be, so you can pop in there and see what we're talking about. And we will try to reference the photographs in there so you know which one's been talked about. It sometimes is a bit of a challenge, but stick with it. Feedback and discussion is first, and Ed House is first. Great show, gents, referring to the last one. Really interesting discussion about blockers and constraints. Time and inspiration are the main blockers in my mind, and I combat the latter by having a number of bodies that I shoot just for the feel of it, like the D80 and the D3100, which gives me the interest to make the time and go out. Thank you, Ed. And he also refers to Chris. The L10 is not the same. It's not the same, Chris, as the Leica Deluxe, from what we can tell. Apparently, even though the lens is mostly the same, it has been updated to improve performance for the new higher res sensor, which also brings better PDAF equipped autofocus and so on. And one last point that Ed wants to make, which is that he's referring to Ian here. One major advantage that this camera has over the S9 is that it's got a mechanical shutter which syncs with flash up to 1/2000th of a second, no less. So thank you very much, Ed, for that nice bit of feedback. Anything anyone wants to say about Ed's feedback before we go to Joe and switch to phones?
I stand corrected.
Not. Oh, right. Fair enough. So, Joe, we've got one which is an article that was posted in the group, in the MeWe group, which is about the Vivo X300 Ultra finally, possibly, challenging the iPhone in terms of video quality. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so it's not a device I've had hands-on with myself, but from what I've heard, it really is a device that can finally compete with iPhones for video. This is both in terms of video quality and, more importantly, the tools available on there to really fine-tune the video how you want. So a lot of the stuff that I've seen is very cinematic, which is cool. You've got a lovely selection of lenses. You've got a 14mm equivalent ultra-wide, which is pretty wide. You've got a main, which is 35mm equivalent, which is very different, actually, because some other mobiles are normally a bit wider than that. So it's nicer to have a main that's a bit closer. And then you've got a 85mm optical telephoto, but there is an option to get a teleconverter as well on there. An extra cost, of course. You've got 10-bit log recording and 4K at 120 frames per second, which is really cool. And for the select few that have an 8K TV or monitor, you can do 8K recording. Not something I'd ever use, but yeah, for the select few, you can. Like I said, the video I've seen is very cinematic. I've got a friend of mine called Jermaine. He's got a channel called Through Jermaine's Lens. I highly recommend checking him out because he has covered this phone and other ultra phones extensively. He may even guest on the show in the future. So definitely check him out. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. But yeah, the Vivo is often compared to the Oppo X9 Ultra. And there's a debate over which one's the best shooter at the moment. And from all accounts, the Vivo trumps it on video as the champion on the Android side. They say stills are subjective. Some edge on the side of the Oppo, but it just shows you it is right up there with the best devices. So yeah, that's my little review on the X300, having not had hands on with it. I did have the X100 Ultra, and it's been one of my favourite phones of all time, even though it was a Chinese version, so I couldn't link my watch and stuff. But yeah, I love that phone.
I think the point being made here, though, is that it's, you know, Steve Litchfield has always banged on about how great the iPhone's video capture is. And I'm not saying he's wrong, but it's been the kind of best standard so far. And I think what they're saying here is that possibly this can be considered to be catching it up or even overtaking it, I guess.
I think it's in terms of, like, especially with the professional tools that are available, iPhone's always offered some really great stuff. So I think in part that's part of the conversation. But also, just generally, Android video is not up there with iPhones. Samsung probably got the closest for a long time. But yeah, this seems to be really professional output from this X300 Ultra, from what I've seen. Some really great stuff, and you wouldn't think it was from a phone, some of it. It really is impressive. Be interesting to get hands on with both at the same time. We'll have to get Steve to try and reach out to Vivo, maybe.
Yeah, maybe so. Has this 8K video thing, though, shooting in 8K, why would anyone shoot at 8K unless you're making a Hollywood film or something?
It is. It's a numbers game. All brands do this. We do 8K.
Right.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know how. I haven't looked into how good the 8K actually is as well, because Samsung had it ages ago. But when you looked at the quality of it, it wasn't great, not very well stabilized. And I think it was punched in on the sensor, and yeah, it was a bit of a mess.
And the file sizes are going to be huge, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, yes. Charlie, any thoughts on that? Have you actually ever used an iPhone for video?
I haven't, no. Funnily enough, I actually tested an iPhone a few days ago and promptly returned it. I purchased the iPhone 17 Pro, and it was such a horrendous experience, Ted. It's something I wouldn't wish on my worst enemies. It was just a horrible device. The UI just seemed broken. The camera seemed interesting, I won't lie. The UI on the camera was intriguing. But that wasn't enough for me to put up with it, really. The keyboard just felt broken, and I just returned it. I didn't like it. I'll be sticking to my Samsung.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's some sense in that. Chris, you've got an iPhone at present, and you have previously had an iPhone. Do you ever shoot any video on it, and could you tell the difference?
Never, no. I mean, I've taken like random videos of, you know, this is where I am for what, you know, sending to people on WhatsApp, but never artistically, no.
Okay, all right. Sorry. Okay, then. Thanks, Joe. That's a nice little roundup. Oh, look, Ed's back. He's got a little work of genius hidden away, he says. I used to dismiss the Nikon D3100's electronic flash release as over-engineered. Why use electronics when a simple spring lever was plenty good enough? It took me until last year to realise that by holding the button once the flash deployed and turning the command dial at the same time, it would let you dial in the flash power compensation. I can't believe it's taken him that long. Look, I'm a Nikon man, and I knew these things in 1842. For a camera series routinely criticized for not having enough controls, I think it's absolutely perfectly usable. In full manual mode, the sole dial controls shutter speed by default. Then when you hold the exposure compensation button, it then controls aperture. Of course it does. It's a Nikon. Hold the function button and it controls ISO. Of course it does. Hold the flash button and it controls flash power. So there you go. Aside from belting rain, I don't see why you couldn't use this control set up to shoot anything. The autofocus being 11 point might do, though. For high speed stuff, anyway. So I'm interested to hear from those people using Sony cameras as to whether they thought out, you know, this I know I don't know much about cameras these days, but I know what Ed's talking about. With Nikons, you were able to just control by button presses all over the place and not have to go into menus all the time, which is really annoying. Do Sony do similar things with their buttons?
Yeah, so
go on, Charlie, sorry.
Yeah, so well, in relation to flash, yeah, so you can get a flash that obviously mounts to the top of the camera, to the hot shoe, and you can physically actually, you know, have like a command dial or actual physical buttons that you can like mash in and select the power for what you want to shoot. Now they do touch screen ones, but I have a preference for the, I think I have a PixLabs, which I use with my Ricoh, and you can just manually control the power. And that's great for like quickly changing, you know, the power settings on the fly. But within the actual Sony camera, there's not really much to do with flash, really. It's mostly controlled from the flash unit itself. Maybe Chris can add to that.
Yeah, if you get a TTL flash, you can control it for the camera. Because the PixLabs you've got is manual. So you'd have to control it on the flash itself. But if you get a TTL flash, you can control it. But flash photography is a massive blind spot for me, and it's something that I really want to have a go at and do a bit more of. So I'm not really au fait with flash photography so much, but in terms of mapping buttons and customization, you can't really go wrong with a Sony. Every single button on the back of a Sony, or the top, or the dials, they can be customized to do anything. It is a massive faff doing it. Leica have the best OS for that, or UI for that, where you just hold down the button and then it brings up a menu, and then you just choose what you want that button to do. With Sony, you've got to go through 100 menus, but it is infinitely customizable. So every single button can do anything you want. And it's quite powerful. Like, you can do this thing called memory recall, where you basically press a button and it completely changes the entire sort of saved UI of your camera. So you can have like sort of four or five different setups for your camera. So it is very powerful, but it's probably overcomplicated. Which sort of goes back to my usual complaint about sort of ancient UIs that have sort of been built on top of itself over a decade.
Yeah, it's over-engineered, I think.
Yeah.
It's the Android of cameras, Sony, but it's
so they keep adding. The trouble is they keep adding features to it and options, but they don't change the UI to incorporate them. So you just end up with more and more menus.
UI on UI.
It's
really the UI.
Which is where Ed's getting away from it, by having multiple functions, like holding the function button and then turning the command dial.
That's the best way to do
press.
It.
Yeah, log presses would be great, and Sony doesn't have that. But it would give you it would double your options, wouldn't it, really, on every button?
Because
you have to memorize what each button does on the Sony once you've customized it. And it's too much. It's like shortcuts in Photoshop. You can't remember them all of the time. Yeah. It's the same with the camera. It gets confusing.
But it does, but to be fair, it does with the Nikon as well. You know, I used to do this all the time with my Nikon cameras, and I thought I knew most of the button combinations and dial changes, but I probably didn't. And certainly, if you don't continue using it, you're going to forget about them. Yeah. So you probably can't win either way around. But interesting little topic anyway. Thank you, Ed. Chris, over to you for some drone news.
Are we on drone news?
So Small Rig apparently has got this add-on which changes the DJI.
That's not a drone.
Action 610.
Yeah.
Sorry. I told you I knew nothing about cameras. Go on, Chris.
This is one of those little we'll talk about GoPro later, but one of these little action shooters, and Small Rig have engineered this rather nifty kind of sort of handle, which it sort of slots into, and it basically turns it into a tactile ergonomic camera. I've read the article that you linked to there, and it actually looks really cool. I kind of like how it looks. It's got a little grip, and it's got a proper shutter button. My only question was, I'm not totally up on the specs of these Osmo cameras, the action cameras, is they're kind of marketing this as a way of turning it into a street camera, but aren't they fixed aperture? Maybe Joe will know, he's a bit more on the video side of things.
I'm not too sure. I've been tempted to get some one of these action cams before, though. No idea.
I'm fairly sure they're fixed or two stage. I think there was a two stage one that came out with f1.4 and f4, but that was it. And obviously, if you're doing a lot of street, then you're going to be sort of
here of a guy wearing it with a neck strap. So he's actually.
I think it looks cool. I think it looks cool.
I think like if you've got one of these for a different use case, and you can then create a little street shooter. For like still casual shooters.
I mean, this action camera is about 350, I think, which is a hell of a lot cheaper than the Ricoh. But
350, did you say?
This bit of kit is 60 quid.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
So it's quite a small sort of, yeah.
And small rigs, really good quality stuff. I mean, everything I've had from small rigs, excellent.
Yeah, I've got a small
rig. Does it look OEM, though, the small rig case? Is it like the same as if it was made by DJI?
It looks snug, yeah. It looks pretty seamless.
It wouldn't have thought it was an additional. Yeah.
Actually, I had a small rig grip for my A7R II, and that was just like OEM. It was like it was made by Sony.
Yeah,
they make some really good gear.
Yes, it looks cool. It looks very cool. Yeah.
Okay. A street snapping street photographer. Being made out of Action 6 Osmo thingy bobs. Okay. We've got a quick one to cover in terms of the PSC Photos MeWe group. And Steve won't mind me saying, quoting himself, that he posted a portrait shot of himself, which he's subsequently apologised for and said he broke the rules of not submitting photographs to the group that have been taken by someone other than yourself. It's supposed to be a place where you put photographs that you take with your camera and not that you've got someone else to do with their phone. So he did admit that he had done this and his wife had taken this photograph instead, and it wasn't his phone. but the question for this group, I thought, was now that we're taking in PSC photos in amongst the PSC photography podcast, is what do we think about this? Is it where if we let people do what Steve has done, i.e. he wants a photograph taken of himself. Let's suppose he hands his phone to his wife to take it. So it's not her phone, but it's his phone. Is it okay that he sets her up, steps back and says to her, please take my photo? Is that still a legitimate entry into the PSC Photos group to be considered for photo of the month and photo of the year or whatever? So up to now, that's been completely banned, because if you let that in, was the thinking, if you let that in, where would be the limit? Because people could say, well, here's a photograph that was taken by some famous photographer, and why can't it come here if someone that's not a member here is... Do you see what I mean? So, Joe, I'm going to go to you first. What are your thoughts on this... this rule, and do you think it should stand, or do you think it needs looking at?
See, I think it can be relaxed, because his wife is essentially a human tripod in this occasion, which is very different from a professional photographer and putting their picture into the thing. I think it's acceptable that Steve's used his wife as a tripod, essentially. I'm all for it.
Okay, Chris?
No. I think the group's getting a bit Facebooky. There's a lot of, you know, here's this thing that I saw randomly. Here's, you know, it's a few too many snapshots. I'd like to see a bit more intent and a little bit more thought put into sort of the composition and the artistic merit of these images. I think we've kind of gone past the stage of showcasing, you know, the quality of the camera and these phones, because they're all kind of excellent at this point. So call me a bit of an elitist, but I'd like to see a little bit more artistic merit to the images that get posted. And if anyone could just turn up and take, like, if I hand my phone to like a Chinese tourist that walks past and they take my picture in front of a nice building, Is that going on? You know, it's
yeah, that's the question.
And like you say, where does it end?
And you sidestepped your opinion there. We wanted your opinion, and you sidestepped it. Charlie, well, save us.
Well, I'm in two minds. On the one hand, I would say context is everything, and on the other hand, I would say I am a full frame maximalist. So it depends, really. If he's taking a picture and it's kind of like a mediocre picture with no artistic merit, but he's doing it because we want to pixel peep at the new sensor in whatever phone or camera he has, then I think that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Even if his wife used his phone as a tripod or whatever, I think that's fine. But also, I think, like, you know, a proper photo, you need a proper expensive camera. So it depends, really. It depends on the context. I think in this instance, it's probably not allowed. But it depends what he's trying to demonstrate with the camera. If it's a picture of someone's dog or some daisies, then it shouldn't be allowed. It should be thrown out.
Okay, I'm still getting a bit confused in terms of the... We seem to have meandered off away from the central question, which is it okay to hand your phone to someone and say to them, can you take a photograph of me or the Eiffel Tower? It might not be you at all. Supposing it's someone that has difficulty with mobility, should we be allowing someone else to hand... They give their camera to someone? I don't know. I'm just thinking aloud now. The central question is that... Sorry, go on, Joe.
Yeah, I think for... again, for artistic, so say they handed it to someone, and for perspective, they was quite big in the foreground, next to a landmark, and made it look small behind them. That might be quite a cool photo, and I think that would be allowed. But just for a holiday snap, no. I think, like Charlie said, there needs to be some artistic sort of view to doing the photo in the first place. But yeah, it's a difficult one. Is this to be considered for PSE photos as well?
Yeah. Well, it's totally for PSE photos, yeah, not for anything else. This is to do with the photographs taken with phones that are put into the PSE photos group for consideration for picture of the month and year. That's all.
So who would win that image? Steve or Steve's wife?
Steve's wife, yeah.
Well, exactly. And the point is that Steve's wife is not a member of the group, so she doesn't have the right to post her photograph in the group. And that's the central point, which I'm trying to get to in a roundabout way.
But then again, Ted, here's the thing. If you stop people from posting their mobile photos in the group, then that's going to exclude someone like me who's walking around with their big camera, who happens to take a really good picture with their mobile phone. So, you know, I think mobile phones on the one hand should be allowed, but, as I said, it depends on context.
I think, Charlie, it's not about what's taken the phone, it's about who's taken the image, not what's taken the image.
Oh, I see. Well, it doesn't matter who takes the image.
I still stand by that Steve is using his wife as a human tripod. He's told her how to frame it, probably. I can imagine Steve's probably been explicit about how he wants it to look. But there is the argument that, that would mean his wife would be the winner of photo of the week or month. But
does that matter?
I would allow it, if I'm honest.
I think I'm with Chris. I think it comes down to a similar argument about copyright, doesn't it? It's like if you press the shutter, you are the photographer. End of story. So in this case, Steve's wife is the photographer, not Steve. And I think I agree with Chris.
In the sense that you should have used a tripod and a timer.
Or not submitted it to the group. This is a family picture that they do what they like with, but it's not fit to be in the group.
For me, it's not a photo of artistic intent. It's a, like you say, a family snapshot, which is fine, but it's not really
that's a side issue, Chris, because someone could hold a camera up to their eye and take a picture of their pupil or their iris, like Ahmed did, for example. But he also could have got his partner to hold the camera and press the shutter, in which case he hasn't taken the photo. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I'm totally with you. Yeah.
So, Ted, are you saying there's more artistic merit to this Steve Chaps actually setting up a tripod with like a shutter cable and taking the picture himself? That has more merit, more value than having his wife.
All I am arguing, Charlie, is the either or of what we say in terms of the rules of the group for PSC photos. Mm. Is it okay for someone other than the member of the group to press the shutter button?
It's not okay. I would agree with what you and Chris are saying. I would say it's not okay because it opens it up to abuse, doesn't it? I would say that the person who's meant to be taking the photo should be taking the photo. Otherwise, you're going to let, you know, standards slip.
Yeah, I think with that in mind, we have voted no. It's not allowed.
Right.
Yeah, I think I see where you were coming from.
Joins the group, then she can post it.
Unless she joins the group, yeah.
Yes, that's different, and that's great. And in actual fact, I had this discussion a few years ago with a couple, and it turned out that the wife of this chap did join the group just for that, so they could do that, which was quite funny, and it swelled the numbers. Right, let's move on. John Tanzer is next. With a good phone in my pocket, he says, is there any reason to have a proper camera? Other than blowing up a shot to billboard size, would I really be able to tell the difference between a photo taken with a camera as against my, say, Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra? And he stumbled into this article on Amateur Photographer, which we will put into the show notes, so you can have a look at the link there, which concludes that you should choose a smartphone if you mostly shoot in good lighting, prioritize ultimate portability, want to shoot and edit on the go, and primarily share your work on social media. Choose a digital camera if you want to shoot in challenging low light conditions, require fast and accurate tracking of moving subjects, want to make large physical prints, or want total creative control over depth of field and lens selection. I know we've covered this topic on the show before. We've had a theme about it, but it popped up this week with John. So perhaps a quickly round the panel to add any thoughts and an answer to John's question. Charlie?
Right. Well, this article from Amateur Photographer is a terrible article because it's assuming that they're mutually exclusive. They're not. They're tools at the end of the day. As I've said before in previous podcasts, you can use a smartphone and a camera, you know, interchangeably. It's not one or the other, either or. I just think they're looking at it all the wrong way. I think, of course, you can use a camera exclusively as your one sole camera if you want to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. It just depends on the user. And I don't think one is better than the other. Obviously, a proper camera is better than a phone, but a phone has many use cases, so I wouldn't rule out a mobile phone. I use my mobile phone all the time, so that's my view.
Chris?
To tackle John's question directly, would I be able to tell a difference? In good light, at 24 millimetres with a narrow aperture, no, you wouldn't be able to tell a difference. But literally any other focal length or any other lighting, you could tell a difference quite easily, yes.
Okay, Joe?
I think it's very subjective on the person. Like I've mentioned, one thing I love about shooting with my camera is the grip and the feel. And there's something different and special about shooting with a camera over a mobile device for me. But it depends. It's subjective on the person.
Would you be able to tell the difference, though, John says?
Would I be able to tell the difference? Yeah, I think you could on a lot of shots, especially lower light shots. Mobile phones are still heavily processed. Even if you use their raw capabilities, they're not always the best. I think I could, but especially when you look at on a larger screen on a laptop or a PC, or even a TV, like I do sometimes, I think I could notice.
Okay, thanks very much. Round the panel, that's good. Do check back with our previous backlog of shows, though, John, because we have covered this before and there'll be some more in-depth discussions on that very topic. Let's get on to today's theme, which Chris suggested, which was long exposure photography. I'm going to have my cup of tea and sit back while you talk about this, Chris.
Okay, well, this is by far my favourite genre of photography. It's what got me into it. It's what gets me going. I still love it to this day. I started it on phones. I think the reason I've really got into it was because you can make an image look kind of, you can elevate it. You can say, this is a proper photo. This isn't just something that I've taken a snapshot of. This is a real artistic image. And I mentioned it before, Even Longer app on the iPhone. Highly recommend it to anyone that's got an iPhone. You just need a tripod and the Even Longer app. It's fiver a year. They do a free version, but if you want raw, it's a fiver a year, and you can just make stunning images basically with a single press of a button. You can choose infinite exposure time, and you can see the long exposure in real time. So I really recommend anyone gives that a go. But that's what kind of whet my appetite, and I found it so rewarding. And then, obviously, I mentioned before, I sort of got into proper cameras, so to speak. First with Fuji APS-C and then with the full-frame Sonys I have now. And again, you know, tripods, that kind of, that's a rabbit hole to get into. Carbon fiber tripods of all sizes and shapes that I've got now. And then you do the ND filters, and there's a whole kind of gear kind of fetish around cameras, which I kind of lost with phones totally, but I've kind of transferred into cameras, and long exposure really scratches that itch because there's tons of gear which you can get to help with that. I love faffing about with the tripod, and I love to get up, you know, at sunrise and just sit on the beach and just sort of spend an hour doing sort of 5-6 minute exposures. And they're just so rewarding because you come home and you just don't know what you're going to get a lot of the time, until you blow them up on the big screen. And they're just so much fun to edit as well, because you're starting with kind of another worldly look to the image, and they've got so much, you get so much creative license because you can really push that ethereal nature of these images, and you can make kind of anything interesting. There's a whole host of images that I put into the photo album. Sort of a lot of it is seascapes, and that's where I kind of started, and that's what I love to do the most, where you can just sort of turn, one of my favorite images in there is like just like a boring groin on Hove Beach. You've got the stony beaches up against the wooden groin, and I've created like a minimal kind of scene. It's pretentious to say, but it's sort of fine art, and you can just sort of elevate really, really boring scenes and just sort of create really kind of interesting ethereal images from that. And then, of course, you've got other forms of long exposure. You've got light trails where you can take cityscapes and you can turn, you know, what everyone else will be taking with boring sort of phone images, you can turn them into real works of art with streaks of lights that are going across. And I've got images in the album, St. Paul's and other places doing the light trails. And even in street, there's an image in the album from Tokyo where I'm zooming down on Shibuya crossing, and people that don't move are frozen, and then you've got the people that are swarming around them that turn into a blur. So you can really get creative with long exposure, and it's just got so many options that it gives you, and I absolutely love it. So there's plenty of my favorite examples, probably not my best examples, but I find them the most interesting in the group. And I know I'll probably stop talking now because I've got rambled on a bit, but I know Charlie's also dabbled in long exposure, and he's made a little grid of for us to look at as well. So I'll pass on to him.
So long exposure, there's really quite a lot to take in. I've included an image here, SWOT analysis. So you've got the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. It sounds complicated. And that's because it is, because it seems very simple with long exposure, but it took me a long time to really get into it. Obviously, Chris is an expert in long exposure. It really took me a long time. It took me about 2-3 years to get into long exposure. What is long exposure? What can we really define long exposure as? So it's basically, it involves keeping the camera's shutter open for an extended period of time to blur moving elements or objects. And that sounds obvious, but when you're just starting out in this kind of thing, it's important to know, you know, what it involves. The strengths with long exposure photography are that it simplifies chaotic scenes by essentially averaging movement. It transforms ordinary locations into compelling images. You can have a street scene with a busy intersection, a road, or a street with many people crossing over, and then you can have like one man just like lying still on the ground sleeping like a beggar or something, and that could create a very dramatic image. I actually saw an image of this when I was planning my trip to Vietnam, and that was really captivating. I haven't got it to show you, but that's just to give you an idea of what you can capture with long exposure. It's really a way of revealing time, because that's what you're doing, isn't it? You're freezing time to create atmosphere. It elevates locations, and it, as Chris was saying, it really creates unique imagery. You can go to a very boring or average location and create something unique. So those are the strengths, but then you've also got weaknesses, and this is what kind of turned me away from long exposure for a long time. Something so sensitive as like vibration and movement. So you have like a tripod, you've got to be very careful where you place the tripod. If you're putting it on like wooden boards on like a dock or something, and there's people walking around and there's a lot of foot traffic, that can create blurry images. Even though if the image looks fine, when you blow it up on your laptop or on a TV, you know, the images aren't crisp. So that's one of the weaknesses. Also, you have a slow setup process. You've got to get out the ND filters if you're shooting in the daytime, and Chris can talk a bit about that later. There's a lot of extra gear that's required. I actually use the Sony app on my phone to trigger my camera to take photos during long exposure, just because even the act of pressing the shutter button can introduce camera shake. So some people, they use a remote trigger. And then also, and this is something I learned early on, you have diffraction. So when you're shooting an image, you often want to make the f-stop higher in number. And sometimes that can lead to blurriness with the image. Maybe Chris can chip in and help me out here with diffraction. Chris, what is diffraction? How would you define it?
I think you need to be a physicist to define it perfectly, but basically the aperture is closed down, so the hole that lets the light in is narrower, and then the light waves apparently kind of hit obstacles as they come through the aperture and bounce off each other, and somehow that results in a less sharp image. But the actual sort of technicality of that would probably be beyond me. You probably would need Steve Litchfield, a physicist, to explain the technicalities of it. But yeah, basically, the narrower the aperture, the more likely you are for diffraction. Yeah.
And talking about weaknesses here, also it's important to mention that even like if you have a camera where you can flip out the back screen, I did this and it was very windy. I think I was in, Hong Kong, and it was actually shaking my camera. It was almost acting like a sail, having the rear view screen of my camera out. So I had to keep that in. So very small things you can do like that can actually aid in your exposure. Also with some tripods like my one, I can't remember the name of it. Chris, what tripod have I got? It's a Y0Y, isn't it?
Ulanzi 0Y.
That's it. The Ulanzi 0Y. It has an extendable
fantastic tripod, by the way.
It is. It's very lightweight. Weighs 1 kilo. It has an extendable column, middle column. So I extended that up to get more height. But of course, the higher my camera was, the more it was like moving about and stuff, and that introduced camera shake, which was obviously terrible. That's something you don't want. And then you've got ND filters. Now, a lot of my long exposure photos are taken at night, so I don't need ND. But if you're like Chris and you use ND filters in the daytime, or you're like me and you just like wasting money on ND filters and never use them, they are something, they're good to have if you take photos in the daytime. Chris, can you just talk about the stops and how they work with exposure bracketing and everything with the NDs.
Yeah, so you're just putting sunglasses over the front of the lens to limit the amount of light that gets in, which will allow you to expand the shutter speed. And it's done in stops of light, but it's kind of like an ND1000. It means like it's cutting out 1,000 times the light, or if that makes sense.
The filters.
Yeah, so if you've got certain ND systems, like me and Charlie both have the Case magnetic filters, KASE, they're very high end, very, very expensive, but they are stackable. So a lot of my daytime images, if that's kind of 5 or more minutes, you'd need 16 stops of ND. So you would put a 10 stop and then you stack a 6 stop on top to give you 16 stops. You know, which will turn what would be like a 1/200th shutter into sort of 6-7 minutes.
You learn how to do that by just experience, by just trying it out.
There is apps, long exposure calculator apps. So basically, you set your camera up and you gauge the exposure with no filters. You just choose your aperture, choose your ISO, which obviously you choose at your base ISO of 100 or whatever it is on your camera, and then you'll see what shutter speed that would give you to get the correct exposure, and then you'd put that into a long exposure calculator, and then you choose how many stops of ND you want, so 10 stops, 13 stops, 16 stops, and then it will give you back the shutter speed that you want to choose.
Right. It does it all for you then.
It does the calculations for you. I mean, a lot of photographers can do it in their head.
That's cheating.
But I don't see the point. I just use an app because my phone's on me. It's not like I'm not going to have my phone on me. So, but yeah, it's a point of pride for a lot of YouTubers that I've seen do long exposures that they can work it all out in their head. But not me. I'll just use the app.
Yeah. Would you say, Chris, that it's quite a kind of elitist subgenre in photography? Like, obviously many people do street, many people do night photography, black and white, but you can't just pick up a camera and say, oh, I'm going to do long exposure, because we both know, I certainly know, it doesn't work like that, does it?
I think there is skill. But I think it's kind of paywall to a degree, and especially in terms of full frame.
Paywall,
you need a good tripod, you need good filters to get good images, but I don't think it's that hard really, because as I said before, you can point your camera at anything that's in the sea, do a long exposure, and suddenly the photo is 10 times as good as it was.
So if you look at other genres of photography, so you've got flash, you've got infrared, you've got drone photography with all the regulations, then you have something like long exposure. What would you say is probably the easiest just to pick up and go and do? Would you say long exposure is probably that in has terms less, of lowest barrier to entry?
Once you've got the stuff, that's the easiest way to get good images, in my opinion, to get interesting photos. I think it's way harder to get a good street photo with no experience than it is to get a good long exposure photo with no experience.
Don't know about that. I think street photography is just a question of confidence more than anything. But
maybe. I don't want to downplay it, because all my favourite images are long exposure, so I don't want to say that they're
It's very technical. That's the thing for me. I mean, you have to think really, you know, in a scientific way, or have a calculator to do it. Otherwise, you're just like
there is a fair degree at
midnight trying to experiment, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're midnight and midday are the best times, because the light doesn't change. Where you do need a lot of experience is sunrise and sunset, because obviously the light is changing. So at sunset, the exposure that the calculator gives to you isn't going to cut it, because, you know, if you've got a 5-minute exposure, the last 2 minutes of that exposure are going to be in less light than the first 3 minutes. So you have to kind of, just for experience, you go, well, it's saying 5 minutes, I'm going to do 7 minutes as the light gets worse. So there is a fair amount of trial and error, but of course on sunrise and sunsets you only really get one go at it when you're doing long exposure, because by the time you know the sun's risen or the sun's set, and you've either got a totally black image or you've got a totally blown out one. So there is a bit of trial and error, and there is a skill to it,
but I think that's why you like it, because going back to my SWOT analysis under opportunities, I put high barrier to entry separates long exposure shooters from the normal camera crowd, the casual shooter, and you've got a big reason you got into it. So you feel like that's like the next step up when you're learning photography. You kind of
you take a long exposure image and you're kind of saying this is is an attempt at making art. You know, this is not just a picture that anyone can take, even though it is, but it looks like it isn't. Do you know what I mean?
And you say, you mentioned with your phone app that you can actually take something that almost replicates what you can do on a full frame. So that leads me to the next.
I mean,
why would anyone use a proper camera when you can use your phone?
There are obviously, you are limited by the quality of the image through the camera. So the lens is going to be worse.
Mm.
And the resolution will be worse. And just in the same way as a still shot, a normal photo taken between a phone and a camera, you're going to be subject to the same differences. But they're not as great as you might imagine. And as, like I said before, I'm a big advocate for this iPhone app called Even Longer, where you can just literally press the button. You choose the exposure length and it does everything else for you. You just press it and it stops and starts. As long as you got it on a tripod or somewhere on a still surface, you can get an amazing photo. And that's how I started.
I put here in my notes that it has the ability to really elevate ordinary scenes into fine art. And also it can use weather to almost become like a creative tool rather than a limitation. So you were talking to me a few months ago about using the clouds and making sure that, you know, you had clouds in your photo. And me and my naivety, I was thinking, oh, you know, I want to shoot, you know, with a nice clear sky. And you were saying, oh, no, you need motion blur in the sky. Therefore, you need the clouds to create that dramatic effect. Without the clouds,
there's a perfect example of that in the photo album. There is a picture of the Brighton Palace Pier where the pier is on the left hand side, and it's a 16mm photo, and it's taken just after sunrise, and you can see the orange streaks on the top left of the photo. You see that image?
Oh, I see it. Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, so in the metadata that shows you it was a 312 second exposures. It's 5 minutes, basically.
It's quite long. What ND did you use for that?
That was a couple of years ago now, but it would have probably been 13 stops.
I'm guessing it's going to stop in
the pre-stop.
Yeah.
That's with the 16-35 fantastic lens. So I was so lucky. I do remember taking this because I used the Ulanzi tripod to take this, and I was shocked that it came out as sharp as it did because it was fully extended and it was very windy.
Yeah,
but the wind was right in my face, so all the clouds were streaking over my head, and that's why you've got these kind of perfect lines that are emanating from the middle of the frame.
Yeah,
so you can use it to your advantage, and I find it works best if the wind's sort of directly in front or behind you, because then you'll get the streaks towards the center of the frame like this. And that's another example of why the long exposure is so interesting. Like, this is the sunrise and you can see the orange streaks through the sky. That is, obviously I've edited it and exaggerated the colours, but those colours were there and added the orange. That orange was in the image.
Yeah, you just enhanced it. And,
so if you take a long exposure with no clouds, you'll get an image more akin to the one of the groin I mentioned, which it would be classed as fine art, you know, where you're just sort of creating a minimalist image.
Yeah, I've noticed with a lot of these fine art photos, whether they're color or black and white, you almost get this kind of like mist effect, this haze effect with the sea. I don't like that.
A lot of the time,
that's the sea. That's the star.
It's a horizon removal where you edit out in Photoshop, you edit out the cutoff between the sea and the sky.
Yeah.
To create this kind of seamless image. Some people don't like it. They think it's a bit much. I really like it, but obviously it's subjective. Similar to the West Pier photo I've taken, the bang on one with the sepia tone on it. It just removes elements and creates a more pleasing minimalist image for me.
I think the danger there, though, this is going into like threats with the long exposure photography, is it's almost like overused. It's quite a common technique, and it's creating cliches in the camera world. You know, there are many long exposure shots which, although they look amazing, everyone's doing the same images. So there's a danger there, I think, where you have these images that are overused.
Well, there's certainly that danger with photos of the West Pier.
Photos of the West Pier. But more generally, when you're traveling, when you're taking long exposure images, a lot of them do look not yours, I'm just saying generally mine, everyone's long exposure photos, they look very similar, and it's hard to break out of that. That's why I like light trails, because I find the patterns the light trails make, they're kind of unique, as opposed to like natural scenes, which obviously more organic, and they kind of blend in with all the other photos. I think that's it's difficult to do, to stand out.
I go back and forth. I think it's probably a good time to talk about the light trail photos. You've got a couple of absolute stunners in there.
I love light trail photos. Yeah, I think they're great.
Yeah, Hong Kong that you've got. My favorite is that Hong Kong where you've got like the three lanes.
The three taxis. Yeah, that's actually five photos merged in one. That took
not that one. The one where you've got the light trails, the traffic, and you've got
with the Dutch angle.
Sets of roads.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
The Dutch angle. You like that photo? I don't actually like.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Oh, I love really? It. Yeah,
I,
no,
yeah, no. I what I didn't like about that was I actually found the sky was too dark against the buildings, and although you can see the lighting in the buildings, I just thought it was a little bit dark. But
so I think it's right. I think it works because that's not the focus. It's slightly in the background. I think it works, mate. I like it how it is.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. There were many other.
It's a perfect
people
example
there,
of why it's so good as well, because if you took that photo at a normal shutter speed, it wouldn't be interesting whatsoever, would it?
No. And also, this is a good idea for like when you take a photo and you want to have all the gear and the lenses. I couldn't actually get everything in the frame, which is why it's at a Dutch angle. So it was kind of the limitation of not having the correct lens with me that forced me to take
creative it restraint. Wasn't
it? Yeah. And it just kind of worked, I guess, in my favor. Yeah, that was kind of like the first long exposure I did. It was definitely experimentation there.
It was coming out really well.
I actually, as you said, with the editing, it's a lot of fun, I find, going transitioning from street to long exposure, especially when I was doing panning shots of taxis. Unfortunately, I lost most of those photos, but I have one here in the album. I mean, they're just so much fun to edit, really. There's so much you can do.
That's an interesting...
We go on to panning shots.
There's an interesting question in the middle of all that, which might have been a little glossed over, and a good yardstick maybe, is would this photograph have been in any way interesting if it hadn't have been long exposure? I think Joe mentioned it. I think that's a very good question. The one that I think might have been would be, Charlie, your one with the two buildings going up with all the lights and converging into the middle top of the frame, I think probably would have stood alone without any of those light streaks in the foreground. But another photograph may well not have been of any interest, like the one of St. Paul's. It would have been a tourist snapshot almost. Maybe that question that Joe put in the middle of there somewhere, I think it was Joe, is a good yes.
Charlie, to be fair.
Okay.
It was very good. I did it through Mind. For two, Charlie, yeah.
I think Ted raises an important point. I think it's more to do with having, in the case of the Hong Kong one, I would agree. I think it probably would look good with or without the light trails. It's just that you have dynamic lines with the two skyscrapers, number one, and then number two on the road. You have the road marking on the one hand, and then you have the tram intersection on the right-hand side. So you just have those leading lines. You know, your eyes forced to go down the image and then look straight up with the verticals. Yeah. So it works without the light trails. With St. Paul's, as Ted said, it's just a tourist snapshot if there was no light trails in it.
Mm-hmm. I think you'd take a different composition on some long exposures to what you would with a different image. It's a totally different field, isn't it? Like
yeah,
you say,
you're capturing space that would otherwise be empty without those light trails, like this like my one of St. Paul's, that's at 9mm, which is obviously getting tons of space of the frame, but yeah, without them light trails it would just be dead air, wouldn't it? So
yeah
mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I never really thought of that, to be honest, but you mentioned it. Yeah,
Chris, can we just talk about your photo here? It looks like it's in Shibuya in Tokyo, where you've got a woman standing taking a picture and there's a man kneeling down. You've just got all this movement with all the traffic of the people. I just think that's such a fantastic image. Could you talk us through that one?
Yeah, so that was, you were with me there, Charlie. We were in that coffee shop overlooking Shibuya Crossing.
No way,
tons of random, I was just experimenting. I was doing all kinds of shutter speeds. I even did a time lapse on my phone that came out pretty cool.
Yeah.
But this is a fairly hefty crop of a wider image because I was just looking for bits throughout the scene. And yeah, you just see these people that obviously, I don't know how long this exposure was. 4 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this was 4 seconds. So they've not really moved for those 4 seconds, but of course, thousands of people around them are. And I need to do more of this kind of street-long exposure. Because, I was really happy with that. But that wasn't the photo I kind of took. This was a wider image that just had a massive crop pit on it.
So this is an interesting point. Combining genres now, so a long exposure that's street. I love it.
Yeah, you can have long exposure street. Why not?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely. You can have long exposure landscape. And of course, also,
panning shots are long exposures for the, generally, because you're moving as you expose, And I've got one image that I was really happy with in Tokyo of the train. You can see it's a panning shot as the background's blurred out, but you've got this row of five people that are sitting in the window that are kind of tack sharp. And that's probably one of my favorite panning shots I've ever taken. So I would class that as long exposure as well.
If you
didn't have that movement in the background, would the picture be worse? I think it would be.
Yeah, it would be. It would just be a train, wouldn't it? But with the panning, it just works.
Another opportunity which you've mentioned is great, fine art potential and distinctive style, is ICM, intentional camera movement. Yeah. I mean, I've put some rubbish examples in there, but ICM is a fun genre to have a play with, which is long exposure, isn't it? And again, sometimes it's a bit of luck, sometimes it's a bit of skill, a bit of both, especially at my level. I don't know if you've dabbled in that at all. Guys,
I've had a go. I haven't got any images. Maybe I'll try and dig them out of like forests, where you do the vertical ICM and you get the tree trunks kind of blur across the frame.
Yeah, because I've put a terrible one I did with a mobile in traffic, and you can see the car lights and the traffic lights ahead, and I've raised it up. Yeah, I liked it as a piece of art. It was a bit of fun. I was in traffic, so I thought I'd have a play. that one came out all right. The one with my camera is a bit pants. It was like Christmas time near, I can't remember where I was now, near Waterloo, I think it was. And I just thought I'd have a go there. But yeah, it's great fun. And like you say, the editing is fun. The editing part is really fun.
The trouble with ICM is that it's a fine line between that you've just messed up a photo or done it on purpose.
Yeah.
and I think those two images are either side of that line, if that's okay to say.
Yeah, no, that's my skill level. I can tell you it was intentional.
I like that image. Yeah, but the other one, I think what's happened there.
Yeah, that one's, if I showed you the raw, it was an absolute mess, and I've salvaged it somewhat in the edit, which was why I mentioned the edit's quite fun. But that was my first ever attempt. I'd only just heard of the genre, and I thought, let's have a mess about it and have a go. And that was with my the Nikon I had, the really old D7000. So, yeah, it wasn't the best camera for it either. It's a fun genre to have a go with, I would say.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to talk about, as we have spoken about phones in there, I know you've done long exposure with the apps, but a lot of Android devices have a long exposure mode. Like Pixels have the built-in long exposure they've done quite a while ago. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Because like the iPhone's got that, but it's only like, it's 3 seconds.
Yeah, it's not that long. I was wondering what your thoughts on the results you get from them. I mean, I shoved a few rubbish examples.
Yeah, I've done quite a lot of the iPhone Live photos where you can turn it into a long exposure, but it's because it's 3 seconds, you need a lot of movement in those 3 seconds for it to kind of...
So it tends to work with cars or something moving quite fast.
Yeah, cars or very, you know, stormy sea or something, then you'll see that movement. Personally, I'd rather have precise control over the shutter speed.
Which
I've not really had on a phone, but I've kind of not been on the phone scene a few years to know whether they kind of caught up a bit since then.
So they do have controls on the phone for shutter speed, but I think it's, maybe Joe can correct me, but it's like fake, isn't it? Like you can change the shutter speed, but it doesn't really, I mean, there's no physical shutter, so I'm not sure how it renders it. Maybe it's done digitally, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'd have to look into exactly how it does it. Certainly takes longer. I guess it's probably stitching images together. Probably most likely stitching the images together.
Does it take longer? Is it, what I'm saying is it like AI and it's just making a fake image of what you take?
Yeah, that's what I suspect it's doing.
And it actually pauses it just so the human can understand that it's taking a fake long exposure, even though it doesn't need to take time.
I'm not sure. I mean, it could be taking loads of images and then stacking them, and that can take a while. I'm not sure. Because, I mean, there's one there with the bus in London. I've actually cropped this.
I saw that. That's with the Vivo.
That's with the X100 Ultra, yeah. And it's come out quite nice, I think.
I like the colours. It's cool.
Yeah. None of these are edited, by the way, so they're just me dropping them in on the bus this morning. And the other one I'm showing you there is on a bend. That's with my Panasonic Lumix handheld. Just me having a play. And I mean, it's not amazing image, but it just shows you can have a play and get a long exposure on a whim, just like that, if you want to. That's, again, the raw, not edited.
3 seconds handheld.
Yeah, it's handheld. Yeah, the stabilization is very good on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That is impressive.
Chris, can we just talk about your image here? You've got one of the sea with the red posts. Can you just talk us through that? That is a really good image.
That is in Shoreham, little sea.
You know what I'm going to say, though, don't you? You should have photoshopped the danger sign and put it on that post that's missing.
Well, I thought about it, but I thought, no, I'll keep that. I I went back and forth black and white or colour on this quite a lot, and I went with colour in the end because I think the red pops, and they are red poles. I haven't faked the red. I have removed the horizon, though, as mentioned before. So in the original image, you'll see a straight line where the sea ends and the sky begins. And going for the fine art kind of minimalism that I like to do, I kind of just remove all the elements that I can. It is a balancing act, because if you remove too much, it just looks like things are floating in midair. So you still kind of need a gradation. You need some shadows. You need a little bit of character in the sky. But yeah, this is probably one of my favorite fine art, if we can use that term. I don't like to, but I don't know what else to call this kind of thing.
It's
fine art genre image. I really like it.
What you're looking at first.
I like the sign being missing personally. You got my vote with that. I think if it was there, it would just be an act of symmetry. Well, not totally an act of symmetry, but something trying to get symmetry. Whereas as it is with one sign missing, I think it's more artistic.
Yeah.
I was also annoyed at first that the fencing's not straight, but I kind of like it now where it's got that kind of wonky. It's not.
I think it's good. Wonky. Yeah.
I think it's especially good because one thing of long exposure is having that lovely, silky, smooth sea and sky. Then it gives it some like edginess to it and something a bit more raw in there. So, yeah, I like that element.
I'll have to dig out the original because this is heavily edited, this image.
Again, that's part of the fun, isn't it?
I love it. But it got a good going over, shall we say.
Okay, Charlie, back to your list. Did you get to the end of that or not?
I think we covered everything there, actually.
Okay.
The only thing I wanted to say quickly, Ted, is we have to be very careful when we talk about long exposures and groins in Brighton, guys. It can be perceived as something different.
Yes.
Well, stay tuned, Joe, because we'll talk about my stint in Brighton.
Really?
Photos last week. Yeah. You might want to skip ahead and click the link.
There is a couple of photographs that we've not covered so far. I think your beach ones, certainly. And you've got, or are you covering that in the next section?
What we've been up to section that'll be in.
Right, okay. We'll leave that for now then. So are we done on long exposure for now?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think we've all gone through all the images, haven't we? Yeah.
Well, let's move into the aforementioned quick panel catch-up then. And, let's have a look at those photographs, Chris, that you've taken and the tale of woe.
Well, obviously we all remember how hot it was during the bank holiday just gone. So Brighton Beach, famous for its crowds. So I thought I'll try and get down there, and I had some drone photos of mine just capturing kind of the chaos. I just wanted to sort of capture the manic scenes from a more interesting perspective. So innocently I went down there and chucked the drone up and got some photos and got them back, and I was super happy with them, and I thought, oh, these have come out really well, and they really sort of show how manic and how busy it is. And I've attached all these drone photos to the group. And they're some of my favourite sort of photos of Brighton Beach with drone. And I thought, I know you'll love this. The Brighton subreddit, they'll love this. So there's a link to this in the notes. I don't know whether you've had a chance to have a look, but I submitted these photos with the title, I think, Drone Photos of Brighton Beach on a Bank Holiday. And it was by an absolute mile my most engaged with post, and not in a good way. There's, I think, stands at 350 comments, which is the most I've had ever on anything. And I'd say about 80% of them are highly vitriolic, accusing me of various crimes, being a paedophile, pervert, should be in prison, I'll phone the police. And I was really, really shocked. I was totally taken aback, because to me, I was just going to take some interesting photos of the beach, a busy beach, with a drone.
I'm sorry, them comments are ridiculous, in my opinion. You're such a distance from people. No, I mean, I haven't had a look.
People on the beach, I don't understand why.
I mean, it's at such a distance. If you had your telephoto out and you were taking a close-up shot of them, yeah, I can understand what they're saying, but this is drone shot. You can't even make out if it's a man, woman, boy, kid. You can't even make out. It's just patterns on sand. I don't get their comments. It's ridiculous.
That's what I like about it, is that it's patterns on a sand. It looks like an abstract, doesn't it? You can't see anything.
I'm sorry, but they're all wankers.
When I had a read through that, Chris, there was some interesting stuff that came out that you and others were quoting, though, about what the rules are or what the rules are.
Yeah, so that's a separate kind of point which has some validity. So the rules are you're not allowed to fly over crowds, which the definition of a crowd by the CAA is a group of people that cannot move out of the way should they need to. So there is a bit of a grey area there.
It's not really a crowd, is it? There's probably about 10-15 feet between each person.
So maybe that's got some validity. I mean, to be honest, the drone flight was like 5 minutes. I chucked it up, and basically the pictures I've got here are all I took, and then I brought it back down. So maybe they've got a point with that. I mean, most of the time the drone was over the sea, so that is fine. That's totally allowed.
I'd say that comment's more acceptable than the pervert one. I think that's just really nasty.
I didn't acknowledge that.
So if the drone is over the sea and yet there's a crowd of people that are all 15 feet apart in the sea, the rules are different, are they? The rules apply to land and crowds.
Well, if you're over the sea, you're not over it. Yeah, because obviously it's far more dispersed in the sea, so that's not a problem.
No, but what if they weren't dispersed? What if they were the same 15 feet apart?
Well, you're not allowed to fly over crowds. So if they can't, if they're in a space where they can't move out of the way of, that's why you're not allowed to fly over football stadiums, because they're kind of hemmed in.
But that applies to over the sea as well, then?
Yeah, it would if they were siloed in the sea. Yeah, that's true.
I was trying to get to part of your defence just now was to say, well, actually, it was over the sea anyway. But the sea in some of those shots is still quite crowded.
There's people there, but I wouldn't ever class the amount of people there as a crowd. You are allowed to fly over people and groups of people. You're allowed to fly as close as you like to people as well, legally, which I don't do because it's a bit obnoxious, but legally you're allowed.
That is then more perverted.
Yeah.
And evading space and more dangerous, yeah. But, I mean, I'm glad you took these shots. I love them. I think they're fantastic. I can see why some people might get upset, but the perverted thing for me is just trolls, people trolling. So ignore them comments.
I think the best one for me is the one in which the left 2/3 of the frame is the beach and the right third with a vertical line is the sea and the light shining off the sea and the crowd on the beach is very uniform in many ways. I think that's my favourite.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
That's the one. That might be the most controversial.
Right.
I agree. It's the best one.
Chris, the photo, obviously we're looking at it on Google Photos, so the quality is high. But on Reddit, does it downgrade the image quality or not?
It does a bit, yeah. It does. It's higher quality than MeWe, but it is still compressed because they're limited to 20 megabytes, the images on Reddit.
Okay. So, I mean, you can't see anything on the photos. You know, it's low res. No, I'm not sure.
Or even on these are full res on the photos album. You can't see a thing.
Yeah. True.
But then there's people talking about the noise and everything and how, you know, it's ruining their day. Can you imagine how noisy that beach was?
Yeah, that's the drone was like trolls.
5 feet over my head and I couldn't hear it.
Yeah, load of rubbish. This is the beauty of posting online, Chris, though. You will get these trolls.
But the thing is, the upvotes, 1,800, nearly 2,000 upvotes, which is incredibly high for a local subreddit,
And with that,
so I think the general sentiment was good.
Yeah, I think that then people don't comment as well. So the ones that like it just upvote and they haven't commented. Yeah. And that's why a majority of the comments are negative, because they're the few. Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about it. I wouldn't even.
It was interesting. It's the first time I've ever had such a response.
Yeah, I wouldn't give too much responses to them all if I was you.
I didn't go for a reply. I did put one post on there to try and say that.
To say your piece.
I didn't post, so I posted some other images that I took on ground level with my Sony just to sort of show the crowds. I didn't put them on there because God knows what they would do if I put them on.
Yeah, then you would be a pervert then, wouldn't you?
But the thing is, these photos of how busy Brighton Beach was, they go around the world in the news. You know, when they're talking about the heat wave in England, they show Brighton Beach. That's what they show.
I'm sorry, but yeah, on social media, everyone's doing the same in Bournemouth as well. Anywhere there was a beach over that heat wave, you've got footage everywhere, video footage on phones. It's literally everywhere. So at least you've tried to put some artistic
stuff. Was the least kind of invasive of all of it, really, in terms of getting in
definitely
spaces. Yeah.
I think it's fab.
But it was interesting. Yeah, it sort of gave me pause posting further images on that one. Yeah.
Don't let it stop you, because you're going to get these people no matter what. Don't let them stop you. I'm sure you won't.
Well, it won't let me stop me taking the pictures. It might let me stop them
posting them on Reddit.
Post them, yeah. On Reddit so much, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so that was my only jaunt out with the camera in the last couple of weeks. But I am off to Thailand tomorrow for 6 weeks. So I'm hoping there'll be plenty of opportunities for some new images along the way.
Mm-hmm. Good. Very, very nice indeed. We'll look forward to your return with lots of said images. Have we got anything else in? We haven't got any images from our community in there this time, so no one's dumped in for critique. Is there anything else we haven't? I don't think there's anything we haven't covered in there, is there? So if not, we'll move on to the news and rumours. Chris, I did post one in about, well, in fact, Ed House was chipping in as well about this Canon's new compact camera, which was going to be nothing like the previous G series cameras. And it started a conversation about Canon's G series cameras, which even though most of them have got, you know, challenged sensor size over the years, Ed and I did have a nice conversation about which ones we liked and which ones we remembered, and going from the G1 through to the G, whatever it was, 16, before they started moving away. And they reckon that this new one that they're allegedly bringing out, I think it's in September, is going to be something different again, but no idea about what it is, no idea about the sensor size, but certainly a photographer's camera and not a, you know, something that's going to be a kind of TikTok creator's first kind of December, a vlogging camera. So, any thoughts on that, or does no one have any interest in Canon?
I'm all interested in Canon in terms of full frame, but I'm not really up on the compacts, to be honest. So no, sorry.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that Canon are recognising they need to be in that space, and realising that it's a very popular space to be in now, and it bodes well for compact cameras. I think it's great to see them doing it.
Yeah,
my thoughts.
Cool. So I don't suppose it'll be anything like as good as the GR, Charlie, but the Canon G series have never tried to be, I don't think. They've always been a kind of hybrid thing, you know.
Yeah, I don't really see what Canon are doing here. I mean, if you want a point and shoot, it's your phone or a GR. I mean, for me, I don't know who would buy this. You either have a full frame camera or a medium format. And then if you want to go out and take other photos, then that's great. Use your phone. If you want to do street photography, you get a Ricoh. That's it. Those are the only options on the market. There's nothing else. There's no point, you know, so it's redundant. I don't know why, you know, it's just
Fuji X100.
Yeah, they're rubbish.
No.
Rubbish. No. Toss it in the bin.
Gen Z. It's all about Gen Z.
Chris, what's like the name of that Fuji camera? The half one, the half frame.
Oh, the X-Half. Well, that is rubbish. Yeah.
They're all selling very well in Japan. Anyway,
yeah, they love it.
Charlie, over to you with the news.
The news. Oh gosh, I haven't actually done any research.
Oh, perhaps it was Chris. Maybe it was Chris then.
Well, the only story of note was this that got my attention was GoPro's sort of spiraling descent into irrelevance continues with alacrity, and the latest documents are showing that they're at risk of bankruptcy. And there was another article which kind of supports this from Petapixel, which said that a DJI have a 73% market share of video cameras, and apparently in Japan it's even higher, which is surprising because obviously there's a lot of legacy Japanese brands and they're all choosing to go with DJI. So it's obviously no coincidence that DJI are dominating the vlogging market and GoPro are sort of spiraling into nothingness, which is it's kind of interesting. It's GoPro's come one of those words, you know, like Hoover or Sellotape. I can't remember what the word is. Maybe Charlie can. Where the brand becomes the thing, you know.
Yeah.
People say, is that a GoPro? But No, it's not a GoPro. It's a DJI sort of action Osmo, whatever it is. So yeah, DJI just sort of running off of drones. They're running off of the vlogging market, and GoPro probably won't exist in a couple of years' time, which is
very sad.
The company that started it all are going to be gone.
Oh dear.
But that was the only bit of news that caught my attention.
I noticed a story about a round head flash. I know that you people aren't particularly into flash, but it just made me reflect about the fact that in all of my years of buying flash guns and photography and SLRs, I don't think I've ever seen a flash guns are always oblong. And yet this company called Zenico have decided to do a round one. Has anyone else ever seen a round headed flash?
No. What's the advantage?
I'm not sure.
Is there a reason?
I've no idea. I think it's just a novelty, but it just caught my eye because it was a novelty, I suppose.
It's quite big.
Yeah.
Like a spotlight.
Anyway, there you go.
Just going back to the GoPro, I just wanted to say, didn't GoPro invent the action camera market? They did, didn't they?
Pretty much.
Oh, and by the way, Chris, the word you're looking for is synecdoche. That's when you use like something to refer to a greater whole, like Hoover for a vacuum, GoPro for an action camera. What's the word? Yeah, synecdoche.
What's it? Synecdoche.
Synecdoche. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't have got that. Okay.
Sellotape's another one.
Another one. Yeah. There you go.
Now we know. Did you have to look it up, or did you know?
No, I knew, but I didn't want to butt in.
Yeah, you didn't want to show off.
I didn't. I love learning new things, so thank you.
I think we're done. Let's talk about the next show, at which we have no Chris. So you can keep quiet in the corner, Chris. Charlie and Joe, any thoughts about a theme for the next show? Or are we...
who's going to join us?
Well, Ian will be here and Charlie will be here. And hopefully
we should do a show on our strengths. So whatever Ian is into, whatever Joe's good at and whatever I'm good at. So it has to be something that's relevant.
Nothing for me. You could
do an anti-Chris show and anti-Chris. Do something I wouldn't want. Yeah.
Phone photography, yeah. I've just shoved a load of phone stuff that I've recently done in the album randomly.
You know what we could do? We could do one specifically about phone user interfaces. Why is the UI on the Ricoh so atrocious? Or on the Canon? I don't know anything about Canon, but someone else might. Or the Sony. Something like that about user interfaces. But that's very technical, isn't it?
Yeah, if we're having a show slagging off camera UIs, I definitely want to be there for that.
Ah, okay.
We'll hang on to that one. Joe, I just heard out you say that you chucked a load of new stuff in the group. Do you want to quickly cover that before we go?
Yeah, I mean, you probably hate all the images, the guys in here, but it's just two phones that I'm playing with at the moment. A foldable, which actually has a very nice camera system, and the Motorola Razr Fold. It's just when you're into photography, random things catch your eye. And I've just done a picture. You might think it's a load of rubbish, but I saw this cloud form, and I took a quick snap of it, and I thought it was quite interesting. I don't know what you guys think of that one. A bit random, I know.
It's nicely defined.
It's not too HDR-y, if that makes sense, that you get with a lot of phone.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well.
Skies.
Yeah, no, there's no, it doesn't
got
look
that harsh contrast.
And this is unedited from the camera, these images. The flower, the bokeh balls in the background are, I think they're really pretty and it looks great. I didn't expect it though. I don't know what you think of that one.
Which one?
So the pink flowers on the 600
the
Pro.
The pink flowers, okay.
Yeah, see all the little bokeh balls, like almost like little lights in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Made the image more interesting for me, the little bokeh balls. I know it's fake, probably, mostly. Although, I think there is quite a large sensor on there. I think it's 1.4 inch sensor. It might be natural, some of it.
We used to call them donuts, but you would get them from mirror lenses back in the day. Are they? Is that the same principles as donuts?
Yes, I think so.
Right. Okay.
Because you get them more. You often get it with the telephotos as well with the compression, but the bigger sensors, you get the bokeh balls more.
So you're calling them bokeh balls, and we used to call them donut rings. That's interesting.
What do you guys call it, actually, out of interest?
Yeah, bokeh balls.
Okay. Bokeh, yeah.
Okay, right. Cool.
I don't call it bokeh balls. I just call it bokeh.
Well, if they're balls...
You said that in Japan, Chris. They'd chuck you out, yeah.
Well,
cultural disrespect right there.
Okay, yeah. you got three more, Joe.
Yes. I quite like hardcore, the portrait mode that you get with Honor devices, but especially the black and white. I love the contrast you get, and I think it's done quite well with the separation. I just wondered what you guys thought of that one.
The statue.
Little statue, yeah, the black and white statue.
I've got the same statue in my garden.
No.
The identical statue, yeah.
Perhaps he took it in your garden.
Yeah.
I was actually going to chuff it out. I don't like it, but...
It's good fun to take photos of. This is not my garden. Yeah, it's probably slightly over-sharpened, perhaps.
No, but it works because it's black and white, I find.
Yeah.
If it was colour, it would be different, but black and white just kind of works, doesn't it, with sharpening?
That's why I particularly like the black and white hardcore. It comes out really nice normally.
Zoom in, there's really good detail there.
Yeah, yeah, it is very nice.
Again, the white flowers.
Yeah, I just I love taking pictures of bees, to be honest. That's why I threw them in there. Again, that's the 600 Pro on the telephoto lens. I don't know, you guys might hate bee photos, but I just think phones are very capable. I just wanted to shove some in there as we now have added phone photography in a part of the mix.
I find nature photography is a bit boring, frankly. I find that they've been done a million times before. And if it's to do with flowers or insects or anything like that, I just kind of switch off, to be honest. Because, as I say, we've just seen it all before. And it's got to be really, really, really special to be of much interest. Any thoughts, anyone else?
I agree with Ted. Not to say I can't be impressed by macro pictures of bugs and things, I can, but yeah, you need something sort of really outstanding to get my attention, I think.
Yeah, no, I can understand that, definitely.
Okay, and have you got any more, Joe? Is that another time lapse you put in, or was that there before?
Oh, that was there before. That was the handheld long exposure shot.
Oh, okay, right, okay. All right, I think we're done then. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time, hopefully, with most of the panel. And I hope you've enjoyed today's show. Phoneshowchat.uk is our website. Don't forget that we're sharing that with PSC now because of the aforementioned reorganisation. The PSC Photography Shared album in Google Photos is linked in the show notes as well and on the website, so you can follow along with this show and look at the photographs we've been talking about. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find everything if you get lost, and that's about all we have. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and well, without Chris. Hope you have a lovely holiday, Chris, and we'll see you.
Thank you.
After you come back, and we'll have great expectations. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye for now.